uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight. And we are going to be broadcasting here live and getting into some news and information for you on the show. It's a Thursday night Moonbat edition with you here, and it is the 22nd of March into the 23rd of March, 2012. So thanks so much for being here with us, and we're going to get through some of the various news items we have to get through today. There was not very much stuff yesterday, not enough to do a show, so went ahead and skipped that. I got to get up here and just regurgitate stuff just because I refuse to do that. Tonight we do have quite a few things to get into. We don't really have a whole lot of emails per se. Not as many as we sometimes do, but we love to have emails from each and every one of you out there, and love getting those and reading those here on the show for everybody. It's become a pretty big part of the show for us. So, yeah, I really enjoy always getting those and getting through those on the show here. GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com is my email address. That's GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. I'm still working with this new setup here for my microphone and stuff, so bear with me as I continue to try out different things and try to see what sounds good and what works and what's coming through right and everything else. Hopefully this is sounding okay tonight. Just let me know if it's not. I know you guys are pretty good at that. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. You can find everything pertaining to my work up there. You can find the archives. You can find news, daily stuff that we post up there, archives, all my documentary films. And also, you can also buy on Blu-ray and DVD my newest film, The Secret Right Volume 2. And I'm currently in production on a film that is going to be concentrating on lost civilizations in the United States, particularly in the South, that all seem to have very interesting similarities and tying that in with the rock wall stuff and giants. And it's going to be fucking epic, to say the least. So that's what I'm doing right now. I've noticed that at the website, and periodically the Chip In website does this, but I haven't seen it do it this long. But for some reason, our Chip In banners are not showing on my website right now, and I don't know why that is, but I don't know how long that's been going on. Nobody sent me any messages saying it was like that. I don't go and look and see if that's, I really go look and see if the Chip-In banners are there or not. They're usually always there, so there's no reason for me to go see, oh, hey, are the Chip-In banners still there? But I was just happy to scroll down or something tonight when I was in the chat room. And I saw that the Chip-In banners were basically not there, non-existent. And we haven't got anything. We haven't got anything in this week, so it made me wonder if those weren't working, and people, yeah, it was there last night. Yeah, I saw it, yeah. But, I mean, I saw it last night, too, but I just mean, I don't know if maybe it did that earlier in the week, too, and I didn't know about it. I don't know. But, yeah, I thought maybe something was up with that. But, you know, I mean, if you can't use that, you can use, we've had some of our regular supporters who support us all the time use the direct PayPal email address version, dayglow76@yahoo.com, dayglow76@yahoo.com. And you can put that email in under the send money tab, and you can choose like personal or something like that. And when you send it, there won't be any PayPal fees for either one of us. And that helps extraordinarily. So if you ever want to use an alternate version of the chip-ins or anything else, please, by all means, use that route. And maybe that's what was going on this week since we hadn't got a one single donation this week. I just thought maybe some chicanery was going on there, mate. I don't know. But hopefully not. We'll see. But anyway, that's how you can support our work and help us out to meet our goal for the month. Both our goals for the month. We have the one for the bills, and we have the one for the initial funding of the film. So there that is. I don't think I have any. Like I said, I don't think I have any emails tonight. I was kind of surprised just looking through here. Do I have any? You know, sometimes I get emails from some people, and they're really good, but I just can't read them on air because, like, literally, they're like fucking novels. I mean, literally, it would take like a 3 or 4 hour, 5 hour show to read some of these emails I get sometimes. And I read them, you know, I'll sit there and read them myself and go through it if it's good info and stuff. And they seem to have a point, but I just can't get up here and read your 4 or 5 hour email. It reminds me of those callers I used to get back when I used to take phone calls. And you always knew they were trying to hijack your show because they'd call in and they'd just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk and wouldn't give you any kind of, you know, any kind of leeway to even talk on your own show. It just became ridiculous. Let's see what we have here in the news pile. Let's just start at the beginning and work our way all the way down. How about that? New temperature record confirms world has warmed 0.75 degrees Celsius since 1900 as NASA potato image shows how planet's gravity is changing as ice melts. So they're saying now that because of climate change, which, again, you know, when you know about these sun cycles and these things or planetary changes that are based on cycles, you can really see through the bullshit of all of this stuff. And that's what this is, but they're selling it to us as man-made stuff so they can tax us to pay for the bunkers and the underground bunkers and the, you know, continuity of government horseshit to save their own asses that they're trying to build, you know, just in case. Just in case. That's really what all that is. But they're saying now that this is actually changing the Earth's gravity. Well, think about this. You know, if the whole thing about the Great Flood and all that stuff, the deluge, all that stuff is just bullshit, right? And we know it's not from the mineral deposits and all the other data, but riddle me this, Batman. How did the Earth's atmosphere, the entire Earth's atmosphere, shrink a great deal because of, you know, some flood? Because it rained. There's storms. I mean, come on. There was something going on, and I think that was some sort of, you know, technology that these people had. It was some sort of weather weapon or something else. Because this wasn't just, you know, a storm that came and you know, wiped everything away. It says, you know, in the Sumerian text, the Anunnaki ordered this flood. And I think that we can start in many cases, when we see that terminology used in ancient writings, you know, when it says such and such God ordered this or deemed this or, you know, bequeathed this or whatever it may be, you know, Anu decreed the earth to be destroyed because of the, you know, their creations and whatnot. But what if when they're saying, you know, decreed or announced or whatever, they're really meaning gave the order for this weapon to be launched? Because it's no secret these guys had all kinds of technology, all sorts of weapons, all sorts of tools and very advanced technology. And they were able to use a weapon, probably something that I would think they probably used an electromagnetic weapon, probably some massive electromagnetic. Maybe that's what something like, you know, the rock wall is. I mean, that thing's got piezoelectric properties to it. It vibrates and, you know, it seems to have power within it, you know, vibration, sound, frequency, resonation. I mean, did they have some Stone Age version of harp that was made out of rocks and crystals, and when you applied frequencies to it, the fucking thing could vibrate at such a rate it could cause the ocean? I mean, remember, the rock wall is right there on the, you know, it was at that time when it was built, it was a flood, it was right, it was a seawall, so it was right on the ocean. So if you had something right there that with all that force of vibration and frequency, right, you know, on top of the ocean, of a sea, and you had that much frequency and electromagnetic energy in that release, what would it do? It'd cause all that water to just push out, probably enough to cause a flood and a tsunami and enough cataclysm to just, you know, catch like wildfire and sweep over the earth. But whatever it was and whatever caused it, and this is a scientific fact, you can go and look this up. There's a video that I posted on my Dayglo 76 Global Reality channel on YouTube, and it was from the 90s, I think. It was a documentary about giants. It had like Jim Mars and some kind of David Hatcher Childress and Brad Steiger and a couple other people in it. But they talk about that in there, about how the there's atmosphere prior to the Great Flood, when the time when the giants allegedly roamed the earth. You had a much higher atmosphere, which allowed things to grow to a much bigger scale, and that after the Great Flood, you had a diminished atmosphere, which caused everything on Earth to be dwarfed and be smaller than it was before. And you can't tell me that that wasn't, you know, part of the weapon, part of the plan. Okay, you know, this is what we're going to do. We're going to launch this electromagnetic frequency weapon that will affect the entire electromagnetic field of the earth, and it will reduce its atmosphere in such a way that if there are any survivors and anybody that we don't wipe out of these creations, they'll be miniature and dwarfed to the point where, you know, it won't matter, they'll be, you know, unusable anyway. And then lo and behold, that exact scenario happens, and then what happens after that? Inky has to go get his dick wet again. Because, you know, then he's like, oh, my God, gee, these, the perv comes out in him and says, oh, these are small. They're like, they're full, you know, they're full-grown women, but they're small. Their bodies are small like children. And I'm Anunnaki. I'm a god. My penis is so large. Oh, my God, I got to get my dick wet up. You know, that's literally what was going on. That's why, you know, that's why the giants, you know, saw the daughters of man and saw they were beautiful and mated with them. Fuck yeah, dude. These guys had colossal god dongs. You know? I mean, think of the scale. These guys are going in there ripping shit apart, man. Our whole fucking species was created on just destroying vagina. I mean, it's brutal, man. It really is the truth. I'm not even trying to be funny. I mean, my God. So, according to this article here, because of the climate changes that our Earth is going through, the planet's gravity is actually shifting with this. Now, that's interesting to me. Updated records of global temperature stretching back more than 160 years confirm the world has warmed by 0.75 Celsius since 1900, scientists said today. The new version of a Met Office temperature series dating back to 1850 adds information from weather stations in Africa and from Canada and Russia, where the Arctic is warming more quickly. The full data behind the study is to be available to prevent a repeat of the ClimateGate scandal, in which scientists were accused of editing climate data to suit their theories of global warming. The report comes in the wake of the release of NASA's GRACE gravity-measuring satellite, which shows the deforming effect the melting ice has on Earth's gravity. Now, this is interesting. So these are called, these are from their twin GRAIL. Remember that? We talked about that a few months ago. The GRAIL satellites that they sent up. Now, that's, I think that's interesting as well. They call them the GRAIL. But according to the GRAIL gravity sensing satellite, this is what our gravity field looks like. That's pretty fucked up right there. The new record also addresses differences in the way sea surface temperature measurements have been made in the past. For example, water temperatures taken from buckets hauled on board ships or made from engine rooms of ships. Colin Morris, climate monitoring research scientist at the Met Office, said the new study brings together our latest and most comprehensive databases of land and marine temperature observations, along with recent advances in our understanding of how measurements were made at sea. These have been combined to give us a clearer picture of what the historical record can tell us about global climate change over the past 161 years. Updates have resulted in some changes to individual years and the nominal global mean temperature record, but have not changed the overall signal about warming since about 0.75 degrees Celsius since 1900. The latest study suggests that 2010 and 2005 were the warmest years on record, slightly warmer than 1998, which the Met Office and UAE's Climatic Research Unit had previously put as the hottest years. But the margin of error in the results means the years were all similarly warmer than average global temperatures. Right, but that's that's the scientists have already determined that, again, those were, that was the sun activity during those times were at peaks as well. But see, they're trying to, it's like they're trying to take the sun out of the equation when they, when they're trying to sell you on their phony global warming bullshit. You know, it's like you're like, hello, what about the sun? And they go, shut up, you work for an oil company, you're a bastard, fuck you. But, you know, that's the problem is, you get these guys. I was talking about that conference a couple of years ago, the other night. Another thing happened at that where, you know, Tom DeWeese was there and some guys, you know, from the John Birch Society, and they're getting up there talking about the Rockefellers are guy worshippers and global warming's fake. And Tom DeWeese gets up there talking about, you know, phony climate change stuff. And yet, when, you know, you look at Tom DeWeese and you look at the fact he's a CMP member and all this stuff. And then you find out that he's a lobbyist. He's for ExxonMobil. So it becomes very obvious when you see that, okay, this guy's out there, you know, running the anti-global warming stuff for the big oil companies, which would be all well and fine if he was bringing up stuff about the sun and, you know, these cycles of the sun and these, you know, these peaks and valleys and everything else. None of that is ever brought up. It's just about whether the environmentalists. So again, you know, just yet another piece of, no matter whether you're talking about left, right, doesn't matter. Neither one of them are there to provide you with any real knowledge or truth. Vatican bank account closed at J.P. Morgan. Image may be hurt. J.P. Morgan Chase is closing the Vatican's bank account with an Italian branch of the U.S. banking giant because of concerns about a lack of transparency at the Holy See's financial institution. Well, no, what they're worried about is the fucking paper trails. There's more paper trails now than there ever is. And with all the hacking and stuff that's going on now, you know, it's very, you know, it's a very good possibility that some hacker probably already has had access to this kind of data. But, you know, if that, it, and it just hadn't seen the light of day, but if it ever does, I mean, we may see things like, you know, the paper trail, you know, the funding coming from Vatican banks and who that's going to, and what operations that's funding and world events that's going to, it'd be absolutely damning. So it's interesting to watch the rats scurry for the exit when the technology they created for control starts to have detrimental effects on their own agenda and their own control system. I mean, I just find that a very very interesting thing. But there's a coup going on in the priest class right now. There's a change of power going on. You're going to see that playing out over the next few months and year. Let's see what else we have here tonight. Supreme Court rules biotech company cannot patent the laws of nature. That was nice of them. Glad you guys nipped that one in the bud. Good looking out, partner. Oh, man, that's a hell of a headline. Biotechnology industry officials are warning that a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on patent rights this week could have a chilling effect on the development of personalized medicine. The Supreme Court rejected two patents covering medical tests for monitoring patients' blood, saying they are too similar to natural phenomenon to receive intellectual property protection. The Supreme Court rejected two patents covering medical tests for monitoring patients. Why did you put that twice in the article? Let's try that again. The patents were held by Prometheus Laboratories, a subsidiary of Swiss food maker Nestle. Now, whoa, stop right fucking there. Did I hear that right? Let's go back up to the title of this article is Supreme Court Rules Biotech Company Cannot Patent Laws of Nature. Great, I'm glad they can't patent the laws of nature. That'd be fucking terrible if they could do that. But it just goes to show you, somebody tried, didn't they? Some asshole really tried to do it. I mean, next somebody will be, you know, trying to patent jerking off in a tube sock. You know? And every guy that fucking jerks off in a tube sock from now until the end of time will have to pay, you know, their $1.50 to this conglomerate who just happen to be smart asses and go patent that. Like fucking Gene Simmons. He goes around doing all that shit. That motherfucking Jaime bastard. Yeah, his name really is Jaime. I think his real name's Jaime. Something like that. I think, yeah, Jaime. I think is his real name. Anyway, he found out that OJ, you know, the abbreviation for orange juice, wasn't patented, so he went and patented. Now a motherfucker gets money from that shit. So, a company named Prometheus Laboratories, that's interesting. You got the movie for the prequel to Aliens coming out, Prometheus. A subsidiary of Swiss food maker Nestle was trying to patent the laws of nature. I mean, my God, man, who needs science fiction? Read the fucking news. The unanimous Supreme Court decision said laws of nature, natural phenomenon, and abstract ideas are not patentable. Well, that's wonderful. It's good to know at least one person somewhere still has their head halfway fucking screwed on straight. Under provisions of the U.S. Patent Act, to be covered by a patent, an application of a law of nature must do more than simply state the law of nature while adding the words, apply it. It must limit its reach to a particular inventive application of the law, said the decision written by Justice Stephen Breyer. The claims are consequently invalid, said the court's decision, which reversed an earlier ruling of the U.S. Court of Appeals of the Federal Circuit. The patents covered a method developed by Prometheus Laboratory for adjusting dosages of thorapine treatment for patients with immune system diseases such as Crohn's disease, a chronic intestinal inflammation. The doses must be adjusted precisely to ensure the drug is effective and avoid side effects. The Supreme Court said the Prometheus patents merely followed natural laws by establishing a link between levels of certain chemicals in the blood and too high or insufficient dosages of theopurine. Officials from the $4 billion a year biotechnology industry say the court's decision could remove incentives for development of other personalized medicine devices. Well, that's good. It's good they struck that down. I'm glad somebody's got their head screwed on halfway straight. Yay! We talked earlier in the week about the Invisible Children guy, whose mind control programming apparently snapped right after. I mean, who, you know, my God. Whose video, you know, your video goes viral and your natural instinct is just go nuts. And they said, oh, he's being released. No, it's no big deal. Well, no, there've been a lot of stuff going on here. I think they thought they were going to get this guy back into the, back into the MK Ultra box. I think he snapped and he's broke and he's not going to go back. Invisible Children filmmaker Jason Russell, who created the viral Kony 2012 video, will remain in the hospital for several weeks for what his wife has described as reactive psychosis. Reactive psychosis. I don't know about you, but where I'm standing at, what I know about this stuff, reactive psychosis to me sounds like a nice way of saying your mind control programming broke down. Because that's the kind of behavior that happens when it breaks down. In a statement released Wednesday, his wife and other family members said they believe this condition caused him to act strangely last week, ranting and roaming around a San Diego street in the nude. Total mind control snap. Total. The family said the treatment could take months. I love this. You know, right when it drops, he's conveniently incapacitated and can't be seen or, you know what I mean? All of a sudden, a crisis happens. That way, he can't do interviews or be questioned on the street about this stuff and ask the tough questions about the connections to this or the agenda. This is see how this is going? So, you know, whether or not he really did snap and his mind control programming really did break down, regardless of that, they very well could just be staging this whole thing to have this guy be on the lam. Because, you know, of course they're waiting for it all to die. Think it's going to just die down. But there's been a lot of people buying into this stuff, man. It's really really sad to see how easily led people can be towards something that they're told to be concerned about. But yet, if your average person tries to get the average person to be interested in issues or topics or things that, you know, are even way more important than this staged Kony horseshit, people don't want to have anything to do with it because, oh, well, everybody else isn't doing it, so I'm not going to do it either. Interesting. Is free will an illusion? Scientists, philosophers forced to differ. This is from Live Science. Are you really in control, or is your every decision predetermined? Who is at your steering wheel? You, your genes, your upbringing, fate, karma, God? A hot topic for several thousand years, the question of whether free will exists may never be settled to everyone's satisfaction. But in a series of new articles for the Chronicles of Higher Education, six academics from diverse fields offer fresh perspectives from the standpoint of modern neuroscience and philosophy. Ultimately, they voted 4-2 in favor of the position that free will is merely an illusion. How can you say that free will is either one? I always felt that free will was something that you either exercise or you don't. Not something that is an illusion or something that's concrete and material. I mean, it's just things are not as black and white as that. But again, science and religion always want to keep us in this. It's a black and white argument, just like society wants to keep us in this. It's a black and white argument with races. You see, they want to keep us in black and white arguments about anything, whether it's about race or not. When free will is you being able to exercise your free will to live how you want to live. And the only thing that's an illusion about that is the illusion that you are exercising free will or you're free when you are doing what you're told by the intelligentsia, the establishment, and whatever else it may be, authority figures, what have you. So free will is not something that you can put a price tag on or put a measurement on. And to say whether it exists or not, it only exists to the people who exercise it. And how do you even know what free will is when you don't even see the invisible chains that are around you at all times, keeping you from ever even seeing your fullest potential. But they always want to take the intangibles and the things that you know, can be philosophized on for long amounts of time with nobody ever really being right or wrong, because it's just one of those things where, you know, when you don't have all the facts, you don't have all the data, you can't really say anybody's right or wrong. But this is a classic example here of how they want to try and, you know, put a scientific spin on anything that is esoteric or anything that may be unexplained forces of nature, because they're afraid that people are going to try and associate that with things to back up their phony religions. And of course, that is what they do. So, but again, nobody's telling the real truth. The only truth that lies out there is the truth you go and find for yourself. Hazmat teams called to Joshua Tree National Park. This is, I see this buzzing around the internet. People have been saying, oh my God, this is where they're releasing the zombie gas. Turn us all into fucking zombies. I don't know if you looked around lately. We're already all fucking zombies. You know, everybody always talks about, oh, zombie apocalypse this, blah, 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 blah. Everybody's obsessed with zombies and zombie movies and blah, 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 blah. Hey man, you think there's going to be a zombie apocalypse? I've had people ask me that. Hey, man, you think there's going to be a zombie apocalypse? I go, there already has been. It's going on right now. Haven't you looked around? They look at me like I'm out of my fucking mind when I say that. I tell you what. You want to know if the zombie apocalypse is on right now? Do me one thing and one thing alone. Get in your car. Drive to the closest Walmart. Get out. Go inside. And walk around for 20 minutes. I guarantee you, before the first 10 minutes is up, you'll be heading for the hardware section, getting an axe, and they don't sell guns or ammo at Walmart, I don't think, anymore. I don't know, just get whatever you can and get something sharp, get a machete, and get ready to start slicing heads. Because the zombie apocalypse has been here for a while. There are fucking zombies everywhere out there, everywhere you go, driving around in fucking cars. My God, they let these fucking zombies drive cars these days. What the fuck's going on with that? Literally, I mean, I literally be out and about sometimes and see, I mean, those fucking zombies driving cars, dude. And they'll just, they'll blow past your ass like they're going to fucking hit you and then get out of the car after the wreck and jump out and, eat your fucking brains. Oh, man. So I don't know what's going on there. This is interesting. We've been, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago about this, you know, theory of roaming planets and planets themselves being spaceships and free roaming around different star systems and different places, and maybe the possible that, you know, Nibiru and Earth and other planets may be that way. This is from Science Daily today, March 22nd, 2012. Runaway planet zoom at a fraction of light speed. 7 years ago, astronomers boggled when they found the first runaway star flying out of our galaxy at a speed of 1.5 million miles per hour. The discovery intrigued theorists who wondered, if a star can get tossed outward at such an extreme velocity, could the same thing happen to planets? New research shows that the answer is yes. Not only do runaway planets exist, but some of them zoom through space at a few percent of the speed of light, up to 30 million miles per hour. These warp speed planets would be some of the fastest objects in our galaxy. If you lived on one of them, you'd be in for a wild ride from the center of the galaxy to the universe at large. Other than subatomic particles, I don't know anything leaving our galaxy as fast as these runaway planets. Such speedy worlds called hypervelocity planets are produced in the same way as hypervelocity stars. A double star system wanders too close to the supermassive black hole at the galactic center. Strong gravitational forces rip the stars from each other, sending one away at high speed while the other is captured into orbit around the black hole. For this study, the researchers simulated what would happen if each star had a planet or two orbiting nearby. They found that the star ejected outward could carry its planets along the ride. The second star, as it's captured by the black hole, could have its planets torn away and flung into the icy blackness of interstellar space at tremendous speeds. A typical hypervelocity planet would slingshot outward at 7 to 10 million miles per hour. However, a small fraction of them could gain much higher speeds under ideal conditions. Current instruments can't detect a lone hypervelocity planet since they are dim, distant, and very rare. However, astronomers could spot a planet orbiting a hypervelocity star by watching for the star to dim slightly when the planet crosses its face in a transit. For a hypervelocity star to carry a planet with it, the planet would have to be in a tight orbit. Therefore, the chances of seeing a transit would be relatively high, around 50%. With 1 in 2 odds of seeing a transit, if a hypervelocity star had a planet, it makes a lot of sense to watch for them. Eventually, such worlds will escape the Milky Way and travel through the intergalactic void. And that's interesting. Interesting stuff there. So, I mean, there's a chance that, you know, our planet at some point or some time was, you know, in a completely different solar system, or a completely different star. Maybe that's what some of the records of the past, why some of the records from our distant past don't make any sense to us. And things like, you know, what were found at the rock wall with some of these rocks, you know, the magnetic field of these rocks being more powerful than the entire magnetic field of the Earth. Maybe that magnetism was caused when we were orbiting, you know, around a binary star system. It's interesting, though. Oh, let's see what else we have. Well, I'm glad that this doesn't seem to be happening where I live, because I yell at my goddamn cat all the time. But those of you in Minnesota, Chaska, Minnesota, a man who was heard yelling obscenities at his cat was cited by police in Chaska, Minnesota. Oh, there must be not a hell of a lot going on in that town. Jeez. Cops got time in that little fucking place to go ticket people for yelling at their cat in their own house. That's just, wow. According to the city's police department, neighbors called in complaining of the noise. Who are these fucking neighbors? The man who was not identified admitted to authorities that he had been swearing loudly at the cat. His defense to officers was that he is human. Police said that this is not the first time the man had been warned or cited for disorderly conduct. He was issued a new citation for disorderly conduct for the recent incident. Disorderly conduct for yelling at the cat? Oh, man. That's just too funny. I love that. So your cat can send you to jail now. What about the little fucked up things that little bastard will do to you? You know? Scratching your ass and put shit in a box that you got to keep clean and begging you for food. My cat has tried to sabotage my entire radio network. Literally. Multiple times. He's pulled out terabyte drive power supplies with his teeth and unplugged UPS, universal power supplies, all kinds of stuff, dude. I don't get to press charges against him. Oh, man, you always love this. They're really ramping up the fear market. Let me make something clear for all the people out there. I've been seeing this going around. Just because a major news outlet has, a lot of these major news sites like, you know, Wired or Wired Magazine, Wired.com, or Huffington Post, or Scientific American, or the London Telegraph, or whatever it may be, they have a blog section of their online newspaper. And these are generally people, they hired to write for them, and it's or, you know, sometimes it's not even that. It's just they give people blogs, and it's not, they're not even really official news people. But there's this trend in some of the alternative news websites to post these every time there is one of these. And it's funny that every time one of them is, there's always a lot of ones that are like, you know, really fear-monger, New World Order type stuff. But they're always in the blog sections. They're never in the legit news. So you can see that, you know, the people writing this stuff are writing this from, you know, they're not writing this from a mainstream news perspective. But it is interesting to see this. From the Scientific American blog, effective world government will be needed to stave off climate catastrophe. So they're not even hiding this stuff anymore, especially the people that want this. And here we go. You know, we've known this was coming for years. They're going to tell us that there's an outside threat of some kind. Kissinger talked about this many times, either real or promulgated. How quickly could we get people to form a global government if we told them there was an outside threat of some kind, either real or promulgated? That people would give up their rights to join into a new world order. I mean, you know, Kissinger said that over and over and over again. So that's, like I stated earlier, I've really said everything I really have to say about this earlier. I just thought it's funny. I see people shitting themselves over stuff that are blogs. These are blogs. These are not, you know, the big-time legit writers. So you got to be careful not to shit yourself and make sure you wipe afterwards when you see some of these stuff sometimes that aren't, you know, actual news articles. Scientists warn of ethical battle concerning military mind control. Advances in neuroscience are closer than ever to becoming a reality, but scientists are warning the military, along with their peers, that with great power comes great responsibility. A future of brain-controlled tanks, automated attack drones, and mind-reading interrogation techniques may arrive sooner than later, but advances in neuroscience that will usher in a new era of combat come with tough ethical implications for both the military and scientists responsible for that technology, according to one of the country's leading bioethicists. Everybody agrees that conflict will be changed as new technologies are coming on. Well, that's funny, isn't it? Conflicts will change as new technologies are coming, meaning there'll be different kinds of wars going on because of different kinds of technology, but it'll still be wars. You know, it's just like when we watch science fiction and we see, you know, these things. You know, it's funny, when I was a kid, when I was growing up here in Dallas, back in the 80s, every morning when I'd get up, when I was in elementary school, I'd get up. And this is long, you know, you got to remember, this is long before you had, you know, sort of the genre of anime and all that. But there was this cartoon that used to come on, and I watched it for the first episode. My dad actually watched some of it with me. I remember my dad, when I was a kid, saying, man, this is a very sophisticated cartoon. It's very, you know, much beyond a lot of, kids' cartoons. And I was thinking back about that the other day, and I've talked about this before on the show, but I went back and started watching some of that stuff, and I had all the comic books and everything, but Robotech, the first Robotech, the Macross saga, dude, I mean, that takes place between 1999 and 2012, and it's this story about this ancient alien technology that was left on the Earth, you know, hundreds and thousands of years ago by a race of giants. Yeah, by a race of giants. But the countries of the world unite together when they find this technology and they create this technology out of it that they're going to use as weapons, called Robotech technology, which enables you to be able to, have a plane that turns into a robot and back again. And when they get this thing fired up, it had like this built-in mechanism in it. And when the ships got close and it fired, and then the next thing you know, here comes these giants. They called it's interesting. They called them the Zentradi, very close to Anunnaki, Zentradi. Yeah, they were a race of giants that had real deep voices, echoey voices. And I was looking back on that, and that series like pulled me in when I was a kid like no other. And it, to the point where, if you ever watched the Macross, the other ones were, oh, all right, the Macross saga was the best. But, I mean, looking back on that now, I know why. I mean, it was like, that's why I wasn't interested when I would go to school every day in the shit they were trying to teach me. You know, because I'd just been watching this, you know, very sophisticated cartoon, and, you know, and they're getting into some deep stuff here, you know. It was just mind-blowing to me to think about that the other night and then see, you know, think about where my research is going and just, you know, another example of this, of how long they've been putting this stuff into the culture and how some of us have grown up where it's just been there our whole lives, you know. But I just love this article there. And there's going to be a serious ethical battle concerning military mind control. You think? I would hope so. Jeez. Oh, man, this is one you definitely got to file on the what the fuck file. WTF. Two human fetuses that were to be used in a religious ceremony were found in luggage coming from Cuba by customs agents at Miami International Airport, according to police. A Miami-Dade spokesman said today that the fetuses were found on January 30th in the bags of two Cuban-American women, one who was in her 60s and the other in her 70s, returning from Havana. Police say customs agents spotted one fetus when they x-rayed a clay jar and found the second when they opened the jar. One was male and one was female. Oh, yeah. Perfect for the ritual. The fetuses were to be delivered to someone in Miami and used in a rite for the religion Santeria, which is a mixture of Catholic and African beliefs widely practiced in Cuba, according to the Miami Herald. Yeah, Catholic and African beliefs. Yeah, make sure you get that right. The two women claimed they received the jar in Havana from a babalo, a Santeria priest, and were asked to deliver it to someone in Miami, but they insisted they did not know what was in the jar and were not charged with any crime. Well, you just let us take them fetuses off your hands, and we're going to let you go free on your own. Thank you. We're just going to go ahead and need to get those fetuses. We can let you through. We ain't going to charge you. We ain't going to give you any crimes, give you any jail time or anything, but we got to have them fetuses. Mm-hmm. David Rockefeller said he was getting a little hungry. Ugh. Fights over water will spark this century's war, says U.S., just like the Bond film Quantum of Solace. You know, they've been saying that forever, but the thing about it is, it's all phony anyway. All the water shortages and all this stuff are being caused by design, by them, by these weather modification programs, Silver Iodine, and the rest of it. They can make it rain as much as they want. They can make it not rain as much as they want. Problem is, they still think we're all so goddamn retarded that we don't even know this stuff exists, when they've been admitting to it on their own for decades. The struggle over access to water supplies could spark global war in the next few decades, according to a new report from U.S. officials. The possibility of conflict over water mirrors the plot of a 2008 film, Quantum of Solace, starring Daniel Craig as James Bond. That film centers around a plan to extort money from the Bolivian government by cutting off the country's access to fresh water. U.S. intelligence agency said in a report released on Thursday that drought, floods, and lack of fresh water may cause significant global instability and conflict in the coming decades as developing countries scramble to meet demand from exploding populations while dealing with the effects of climate change. All by design, all so they can create, you know, artificial scarcity like they do everything. That's why they wanted to control everything, so they can create and control the artificial scarcity, because whoever controls the artificial scarcity is going to control everything. How many movies have we seen this in? Wasn't that in fucking Total Recall? Guy was controlling all the air on Mars from the ancient alien air supply thing in there. Could life hop between worlds in a solar system in the form of living microbes carried through space on rocks? Scientists have simulated rocks hurtling through the distant Galois 581 system. The solar system thought most likely to harbor life due to its upper Earth planet, D, which falls in a habitable zone where liquid water could exist. One of the big scientific questions is how did life spread, says Professor Jay Malosh. In our solar system, a lot of exchange that takes place. It's quite possibly life started on Mars and came to Earth. There's also been a great deal of discussion about the possible spread of life in the universe from star to star. Moon rocks in Mars meteorites have been found on Earth, which led Malosh to previously suggest living microbes could be exchanged among planets in a similar manner. Brock examined the Gliese 581 planetary system because Planet D, known as a super-Earth, falls in a habitable zone where liquid water could possibly exist. Lacey has found that somewhat surprising result, that it is very difficult for materials to spread throughout the system in the same way, could take place in our solar system. So, is this like panspermia theory stuff here? That's what it sounds like to me. This is interesting, though. I've heard people talk about this, about, you know, the fact that Mercury being so close to the sun, you know, still is has very spots that are very, you know, ice cold, when you wouldn't think that it would. Could ice lurk at Mercury's poles? NASA probe finds bright deposits deep in shadowed craters on the planet's hot surface. Water ice could survive at Mercury's poles, according to data from NASA's MESSENGER probe, shielded from the sun's scorching rays deep inside permanently shadowed craters. The planet, the innermost in our solar system, can reach temperatures above 400 degrees Celsius. But scientists have wondered whether radar-bright deposits seen in scans might be water ice. NASA's MESSENGER probe has sent back images that show the bright deposits map to dark craters and permanent shadow, lending weight to the theory that they might be ice. We never had the imagery available before to see the surface where these radar-bright features are located. MDIS images show that all the radar-bright features near Mercury's south pole are located in areas of permanent shadow. And near Mercury's north pole, such deposits are also seen only in shadowed regions. Results consistent with the water ice hypothesis. Okay, so what? What's the big deal about that? I'm reading this article, it goes on and on and on. But they're not really telling us anything why that's important. And don't you love reading news stories like that? It happens to me all the time. You'll read through these and you get to know, okay, what was the point of that story? What are they doing? I mean, you know, sometimes if you really know what's going on, you're paying attention, you go, oh, you know, it's talking about this. But if you don't, you don't have any context, and you're just like, you know, what the hell was that about? Most powerful laser pulse in history is fired in the U.S. nuclear fusion plant as scientists bid to harness the power of the H-bomb. The most energetic laser shot in mankind's history was fired at the stadium-sized National Ignition Facility in California this month. Now, that's the National Ignition Facility, I talked about that several years ago, is producing these lasers at such high intensity that some people have believed that they're attempting to open up that, and indeed is where they're attempting to open up the Stargate. Is at the National Ignition Facility. Now, if you do some research into the National Ignition Facility, I bet you'd find some things on your own that would probably support that idea. I dare you to research it. National Ignition Facility. On March 15th, an array of 192 lasers fired a shaped pulse of energy that generated 411 trillion watts. 411 trillion watts of peak power. 1,000 times more than the whole of the United States uses at any one moment. The pulse is a historic moment for the fusion facility, which aims to generate power using a nuclear fusion reaction, similar to what happens in hydrogen bombs. The pulse only lasted for 23 billionths of a second. The laser array was not firing at a target, but within 2 years, scientists will fire the 192 lasers at a 1 millimeter pellet of hydrogen. The NIF scientists hope that it will light the fuse for a fusion reaction, the reaction that powers stars, which will release more energy than the lasers put in. controlled nuclear fusion, the reaction is in a hydrogen bomb is uncontrolled, is a holy grail of clean energy that scientists have sought to crack since the 50s. Because of the incredibly short duration of the pulse, the total amount of energy required is not as huge as it sounds, as it is stored in huge battery-like capacitors at NIF. This event marks a key milestone in the National Ignition Campaign's drive towards fusion ignition. They've had fusion and all that stuff. They've had it all for years and years and years, shelved. They kill off every person that comes out with a dude. Now this is an artificial rollout. They'll probably roll this out in the middle of Obama's second term, right when things are starting to get really bad, and claim that, you know, just like the Messiah that he is, that he, you know, got Osama bin Laden and all this other stuff, he's going to bring us cold fusion. Yes, yeah. Well, they've had that for years. Space experts are trying to solve the mystery of a UFO fragment which crashed close to a village in Siberia. Locals insist the metallic object, which resembles a large rubbish bin, fell from the skies, but initial checks by experts have concluded it is neither from a rocket nor a missile. Is now under police guard as interest in the visitor intensifies. Weighing 200 kilograms and around 2 meters in height, locals fixed it to a trailer and took it across the snow to the village where local inspectors checked it. The object found is not related to space technology. A final conclusion can be made after a detailed study of the object by experts. Locals insist the metallic object, resembling a large shiny rubbish bin, fell from the skies. The object is 6 feet long, and it is at least partially made of titanium steel. And they said it's not from a rocket. It's not from anything. They don't know what it's from. It's probably from something they, you know, are not telling us they have. That's one of their most favorite things to do. Microquake near Wisconsin City bothered by booms. Now, they're saying that the mysterious sounds of Wisconsin we were talking about are now being caused by earthquakes. But how can an earthquake cause something to happen for that long of a period of time? A minor earthquake occurred this week near the eastern Wisconsin city where researchers have been investigating a series of unexplained booming sounds, federal geologists said Thursday. The U.S. Geological Survey said the 1.5 magnitude earthquake struck Tuesday just after midnight in Clintonville, a town of about 4,600 people, about 40 miles west of Green Bay. Geophysicist Paul Caruso told the Associated Press that loud booming noises have been known to accompany earthquakes. It is possible the mysterious sounds that the officials have been investigating are linked to the quake, he said. Earthquakes can generate seismic energy that moves through rock at thousands of miles per hour, producing a sonic boom when the waves come too close to the surface. I still think it's probably, you know, it could be anything. I don't know. People speculate they're building underground bunkers. It could be anything, but I see how they're trying to cover it up under the rug as quickly as possible. That lets you know what's up there, that there's definitely something they don't want us to know, so they're trying to, oh, it's swamp gas, yeah, swamp gas, that's it, yeah. Oh, man. It just continues to be out of fucking control, doesn't it? Let's take a break, come back, and get into more for you here tonight. This is the Global Reality. Stay with us.
The moon is calling, the seas are calling, now I cannot sleep. It's saying something, projecting something, signals from the deep. I read it somewhere that we will be in the heat. It's hard to believe, but I hear voices and I cannot keep it secret. The computers, the
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us. And we're going to be getting into our continuing series of reading of Zachariah Sitchin's The End of Days. We're almost done. Not much farther to go here, so we're going to be getting into that with you here on the broadcast tonight. Thanks to everybody out there for being with us. If you're listening on a YouTube video later on or an archive show, wherever you're listening, however you're listening, thanks so much for joining us and being a part of what I'm trying to do here with the information. And thanks to everybody's comments. A lot of people have now seen the complete Secret Rite Volume 2, and it clicked for a lot of people the way it clicked for me. After they saw the film, you know, people are now like, oh man, you know, everything that they had been suspicious of, they're now seeing. Oh yeah, you know, I definitely see why this is relevant. So thanks to everybody out there who has had the stones, the courage, the balls to look at that information and then try to get other people to look at it as well. That's, there's far fewer of you out there doing that than there should be, but the fact of the matter is that it's going to spread, and I just, I continue to be hopeful that at some point, the resources will present themselves. It'll enable us to be able to get that film. So I'm not giving up on getting that film out to a wide audience. I mean, I still want to get it on iTunes and Netflix, just because I know that'd be a huge thing for us. But, you know, it's like $1,500 to do that. But I'm really trying to put all my resources I have now towards the new film and the new project. But I'm still not giving up on that because I really want it to reach, a wide audience. But just thanks to everybody out there who continues to support what we do and what I'm trying to do here. And I thank you so much. And we have a goal set for the new film. We need to meet that. And that's our immediate goal for that for now. So there you go. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. That's where you can support our work. You absolutely can't use PayPal. We have a P.O. box there as well. All right, let's burn through some of this. We're getting close to the end now. But the Anunnaki came and went during a window of opportunity when Nibiru arrived at perigee, nearest the sun and thus closest to the Earth and Mars. It's so obvious that some readers of mine used to simply deduct 3,600 from 4,000 as a round date for Anu's last visit, resulting in 400 BCE, or deduct 3,600 from 3760 when Nippur calendar began, as the Maccabees did, and arrive at 160 BCE. Either way, the next arrival of Nibiru is way in the distant future. In fact, as the reader now knows, Nibiru arrived earlier, circa 560 BCE. When considering that digression, one must keep in mind that the perfect SAR, 3600, has always been a mathematical orbital period. Because celestial orbits of planets, comets, asteroids digress from orbit to orbit due to the gravitational tug of other planets near which they pass, to use the well-tracked Halley's Comet as an example, its given period for 75 years actually fluctuates from 74 to 76. When it last appeared in 1986, it was 76 years. I remember that. I was 10. I remember we went out camping or something for the weekend, and we could actually see it with binoculars. I remember getting to see it, and I remember people saying, well, remember this, because it won't be around for another, you remember when you saw Halley's Comet? I remember it was a big deal, So, yeah, I saw Halley's Comet. It'll come again when I'm 86 years old, if I haven't already shuffled off this mortal coil by then. But I guess with the live extension technologies we got now, I just might see it. You never know, right? Oh, man. I doubt I'll ever be able to afford any of that. extend Halley's digression in Nibiru 3600, and you get a plus minus variant of about 50 years each way. There is one other reason for wondering why Nibiru had digressed so much from its wanted SAR, the unusual occurrence of the deluge circa 10900 BCE. During its 120 SAR before the deluge, Nibiru orbited without causing such a catastrophe. Then something unusual happened that brought Nibiru closer to Earth. Combined with the slippage conditions of the ice age sheet covering Antarctica, the deluge occurred. What was that something unusual? Well, that's synchronistic. That's what I was just talking about. You know, something happened that was unusual because whatever it was caused our atmosphere to shrink so that there could no longer be anything large. I mean, it sounds like some ancient-ass eugenics, doesn't it? Sounds like Al Gore was running around back in those days, the deluge days or something. Well, I think what we have to do when we have this flood is to make sure that nobody can ever grow big again. Because if people don't grow big again, then we will use less resources. And you need to buy my movie, Inconvenient Truth. It's out right now. Yeah! Maybe that's what it was. These big fuckers eat too much. We need to shrink these hoes down a little bit. And so, you know, we'll just make more of them. We'll just program them to want to fuck constantly. Program them to want to, you know, do nothing but procreate the species. Fuck, bang, 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 bang. Dick wet. So we'll produce more of them since they'll be, you know, smaller. Does sound like there was some thought behind that, doesn't there? The answer may well lie farther out in our solar system where Uranus and Neptune orbit. Planets whose many moons include some that inexplicably orbit in an opposite retrograde direction than the way Nibiru orbits. One of the great mysteries in our solar system is the fact that the planet Uranus literally lies on its side. Its north-south axis faces the sun horizontally instead of being vertical to it. Something gave Uranus a big whack sometime in the past. Something gave Uranus a big whack. Whack. Yeah, Uranus. NASA scientists said without venturing to guess what the something was, I have often wondered whether that something was also what caused that huge, mysterious chevron scar and an unexplained plowed feature that NASA's Voyager 2 found on Uranus's moon Miranda in 1986. A moon that is different in numerous ways from the other moons of Uranus. Could a celestial collision with a passing Nibiru and its moons cause all that? In recent years, astronomers have ascertained that the outer large planets have not stayed put where they were formed, but have been drifting outward away from the sun. The studies concluded that the shift has been most pronounced in the case of Uranus and Neptune, and that can explain why nothing happened out there for many Nibiru orbits, then suddenly something did. It is not implausible to assume that on its deluge orbit, Nibiru encountered the drifting Uranus and one of Nibiru's moons struck Uranus, tilting it on its side. It could even be that the strike weapon was the enigmatic moon Miranda, a moon of Nibiru striking Uranus and ending up captured to orbit Uranus. Such an occurrence would have affected the orbit of Nibiru, slowing it down to about 3,450 Earth years rather than 3,600 and resulting in a post-diluvial reappearance schedule of circa 7,450, circa 4,000, and circa 550 BCE. If that is what had happened, it would explain the early arrival of Nibiru in 556 BCE and suggest that its next arrival will be circa AD 2900. For those who associate the prophesied cataclysmic events with the return of Nibiru or Planet X, to some, the time is not at hand. But any notion that the Anunnaki limited their comings and goings to a single short window at the planet's perigee is, however, incorrect. They could keep coming and going at other times as well. The ancient texts record numerous instances of back-and-forth travel by the gods with no indication of a link to the planet's proximity. There are also a number of tales of Earth, Nibiru, travel by Earthlings that omit any assertion of Nibiru seen in the skies, a sight stressed, on the other hand, when Anu visited Earth circa 4000 BCE. In one instance, Adapa, a son of Enki, by an Earthling woman who was given wisdom but not immortality, paid a very short visit to Nibiru accompanied by the gods Dumuzi and Ningishida, and Enoch, emulating the Sumerian Edmuranki, also came and went twice in his lifetime on Earth. This was possible in at least two ways, as shown in the drawing. One, by a spaceship accelerating on Nibiru's incoming phase from point A, arriving well ahead of perigee time. The other, by accelerating a spacecraft during Nibiru's outbound phase, falling back toward the sun and thus to Earth and Mars. A short visit to Earth like the one by Anu could take place by combining A for arrival and B for outbound departure. A short visit to Nibiru, as by Adapa, could take place by reversing the procedure, by leaving Earth to intercept Nibiru at A and departing from Nibiru at B for the return to Earth, and so on. A return of the Anunnaki at a time other than the planet's return can thus take place. And for that, we are left with the other cyclical time, zodiacal time. I have called it, in When Time Began, celestial time, distinct from yet serving as a link between earthly time, our planet's orbital cycle, and divine time, the clock of the Anunnaki's planet. If the expected return will be of the Anunnaki rather than of their planet, then it behooves us to seek the solution to the enigmas of gods and men through the clock that has linked them, the cyclical zodiac of celestial time. It was invented, after all, by the Anunnaki as a way to reconcile the two cycles. Their ratio, 3600 for Nibiru, 2164 zodiacal age, was the golden ratio of 10 to 6. It resulted, I have suggested, in the sexagesimal system on which Sumerian mathematics and astronomy were also based. Berossus, as we have mentioned, deemed the zodiacal ages to be the turning points in the affairs of gods and men, and held that the world periodically undergoes apocalyptic catastrophes, either by water or by fire, whose timing is determined by heavenly phenomena. Like his counterpart, Manetho, in Egypt, he also divided prehistory and history into divine, semi-divine, and post-divine phases. With a grand total of 2,160,000 years of the duration of this world, this wonder of wonders is exactly 1,000 a millennium, zodiacal ages. Scholars studying ancient clay tablets dealing with mathematics and astronomy were astounded to discover that the tablets used the fantastic number of 12,960,000 as a starting point. They concluded that this could only be related to the zodiacal ages of 2,160, whose multiples result in 12,960. A wonder of wonders, the fantastic number with which these ancient lists begin, 12,960,000, is a multiple of 2,160 by 6,000, as in the divine 6 days of creation. That major event within the affairs of the gods affected the affairs of men and were linked to the zodiacal ages, and it has been shown throughout this volume of the Earth Chronicles. As each age began, something momentous took place. The age of Taurus signaled the grant of civilization to mankind. The age of Aries was ushered in by the nuclear upheaval and ended with the departure. The age of Pisces arrived with the destruction of the temple and the beginning of Christianity. Should one not wonder whether the prophetic end of days really means end of the zodiacal age? Well, that's the best question I've ever heard Zach Rasichin ask right there. Were the times and a half of Daniel simply a terminology referring to zodiacal ages? I'll tell you this. The Temple of Hathor at Dendera, which is one of my, you know, big long-term, big life projects, bucket list things to do. I want to make a film and travel to Egypt and go to the Temple of Hathor and write a book about it and do the whole deal. Because it just hasn't been covered. And if you ever want proof that there was extraterrestrial involvement in mankind, you needn't look any further than the Temple of Hathor at Dendera. It has a zodiacal wheel on the ceiling way high up there that predates astronomy by like 5,000 years. It's built to the scale of giants. And, I mean, it's just amazing when you see the scale of it, when you see somebody. There's this great picture, and I'll see if I can find it. There's a great picture of this guy, Egyptian guy, standing in or sitting down next to one of the pillars, some of the pillars inside of the Temple of Hathor, Dendera, in Egypt. And it's just amazing because he... The guy looks here. I got it. You can just see how massive these structures are. And, of course, as usual, Chitango took a shit and won't allow it to be posted. What a big surprise. Fucking Chitango. Anyway, yeah. That's what you, Temple Hathor Dendera. Google image that shit and go look at it for yourself. Let's see where I left off here. The possibility was pondered some three centuries ago by none other than Sir Isaac Newton, best known for his formulation of the natural laws governing celestial motions, such as planets orbiting the sun. His interests also lay in religious thought, and he wrote lengthy treatises about the Bible and biblical prophecies. He considered the celestial motions that he formulated to be the mechanics of God. And he strongly believed that the scientific discoveries that began with Galileo and Copernicus and were continued by him were meant to happen when they did. This led him to pay particular attention to the mathematics of Daniel. In March 2003, the British Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, startled the scientific and religious establishments with a program on Newton that revealed the existence of a document, handwritten by him on front and back, that calculated the end of days according to Daniel's prophecy. Newton wrote his numerical calculations on one side of the sheet, and his analysis of the calculations as seven propositions on the paper's other side. A close examination of the document, a photocopy of which I am privileged to have, reveals that the numbers that he used in the calculations include 216 and 2160 several times. A clue to me to understand what his line of thought was, he was thinking of zodiacal time. To him, that was the messianic clock. He summed up his conclusions by writing down a set of three, not before and not later than, timetable for Daniel's prophetic clues. Between 2132 and 2370, according to one clue given to Daniel, between 2090 and 2374, according to a second clue, between 2060 and 2370, for the crucial time, times, and half time. Sir Isaac Newton predicted that the world would end in the year 2060, the BBC announced. Not exactly, perhaps, but as the table of zodiacal ages in an earlier chapter shows, he was not far off of the mark in two of his not earlier than dates of 2060 and 2090. The original cherished document of the great Englishman is now kept in the Department of Manuscripts and Archives of the Jewish National and University Library in Jerusalem. a coincidence? It was in my 1990 book, Genesis Revisited, that the Phobos incident, a hushed-up event which was first publicly revealed, it concerned the loss in 1989 of the Soviet spacecraft sent to explore Mars and its possibly hollow moonlet called Phobos. Oh, yeah, they saw the shadow appear right before the... you could see the shadow appear on the surface of Mars right before their spacecraft went tits up. In fact, not one but two Soviet spacecraft were lost, named Phobos 1 and Phobos 2 to indicate their purpose, to probe Mars' moonlet, Phobos. They were launched in 1988 to reach Mars in 1989. Though a Soviet project, it was supported by NASA and European agencies. Phobos 1 just vanished. No details or explanation were ever publicly given. Phobos 2 did make it to Mars and started to send back photographs taken by two cameras, a regular one and an infrared one. Amazingly or alarmingly, they included pictures of the shadow of a cigar-shaped object flying in the planet's skies between the Soviet craft and the surface of Mars. Yeah, I've seen it. It indeed did catch something there right before it went tits up. The Soviet mission chief described the object that cast the shadow as something which some may call a flying saucer. Immediately, the spacecraft was directed to shift from Mars orbit to approach the moonlet and from a distance of 50 yards bombard it with laser beams. The last picture Phobos 2 sent showed a missile coming at it from the moonlet. Immediately after that, the spacecraft went into a spin and stopped transmitting, destroyed by the mysterious missile. The Phobos incident remains officially an unexplained incident. In fact, right thereafter, a secret commission on which all the leading space nations were represented sprang into action. The commission and the document it formulated merit more scrutiny than they received, for they hold the key to understanding what the world's leading nations really know about Nibiru and the Anunnaki. The geopolitical events that resulted in the secret group's formation began with the discovery in 1983 of a Neptune-sized planet by RAS, NASA's infrared astronomical satellite, which scanned the edges of the solar system, not visually, but by detecting heat-emitting celestial bodies. The search for a 10th planet was one of its stated objectives, and indeed it found one, determining that it was a planet because, detected once and then again 6 months later, it was clearly moving in our direction. The news of the discovery made headlines, but was retracted the next day as a misunderstanding. In fact, the discovery was so shocking that it led to a sudden change in U.S.-Soviet relations. A meeting and an agreement for space cooperation between President Reagan and Chairman Gorbachev, and public statements by the President at the United Nations and other forums that included the following words, pointing heavenwards with his finger as he said them. Just think how easy his task and mine might be in these meetings. That we held if suddenly there was a threat to this world from some other species from another planet outside in the universe. I occasionally think how quickly our differences would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. The working committee that was formed as a result of these concerns conducted several meetings in leisurely consultation until the March 1989 Phobos incident. Working feverishly, it formulated in April 1989 a set of guidelines known as the Declaration of Principles concerning activities following the direction of extraterrestrial intelligence. Wow. The Declaration of Principles concerning activities following the detection of extraterrestrial intelligence, by which the procedures to be followed after receiving a signal or other evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence were agreed. The signal, the group revealed, might not be simply one that indicates its intelligent origin, but could be an actual message that may need decoding. The agreed procedures included undertakings to delay disclosure of the contact for at least 24 hours before a response is made. This was surely ridiculous if the message had come from a planet light years away. No, the preparations were for a nearby encounter. To me, all these events since 1983, plus all the evidence from Mars briefly described in previous chapters, and the missiles shot out from the moonlit Phobos indicate that the Anunnaki still have a presence, probably a robotic presence, on Mars, on their Olden Way station. They could indicate forethought, a plan to have a facility ready for a future revisit. Put together, it suggests an intent for a return. To me, the Earth-Mars cylinder seal is both a depiction of the past and a foretelling of the future, because it bears a date indicated by the sign of two fishes, the age of Pisces. Does it tell us? What does it tell us? What had taken place in a previous age of Pisces will be repeated again in the age of Pisces. If the prophecies are to come true, if the first things shall be the last things, if the past is the future, the answer has to be yes. We are still in the age of Pisces. The return, the signs say, will happen before the end of our current age. So that's the end of that chapter. We have the postscript now. In November 2005, a major archaeological discovery was made in Israel. While clearing the ground for a new structure, the remains of an ancient large building came to light. Archaeologists were summoned to supervise careful excavation. The building turned out to be a Christian church, the oldest one ever found in the Holy Land. Inscriptions in Greek suggest it was built or rebuilt in the 3rd century AD as the ruins were cleared. A magnificent mosaic floor came into view. In its center was a depiction of two fishes, the zodiacal sign of Pisces. What is significant about that? The site of the discovery is Megiddo. At the foot of Mount Megiddo, Har-Megiddo, another coincidence. What he doesn't tell you here is where those two fishes are at, where that's at. They actually go there in the show Legend Quest on Sci-Fi. And it's funny, they wouldn't let them uncover it and stuff, but it's, guess where that Megiddo site is, where the two fishes are? It's inside of a maximum security prison. I mean, you think it's bad they built an entire town on top of a rock wall. In Israel, they built a fucking maximum security prison on top of Megiddo, on top of where these, you know, the oldest symbol of these fish are. And, of course, they go on and do some other disinfo bullshit in the show, but wow. So that's it, man. That's it. We're completely done. That is the End of Days by Zacharias Sitchin. And I enjoyed reading it. Hope you enjoyed reading it. I don't agree with everything in it, but I don't agree with everything of anybody. But I did enjoy reading it, and I'll be making my decision in the next few days what my next reading is going to be. And we'll be moving on from there. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. We haven't got any support, any donations in at all this week. Not one single penny. And we have to be able to live and continue to survive and do this work every day. And I'm working day and night continuing to put together all this rock wall stuff. And it's going to be a doozy. So help us out with the chipping banner for the Bills for the Month if you can. Help us out with the one for the rock wall film if you can. Either way, we appreciate everybody out there continuing to support what we do here. And we hope you'll continue to spread the word. My name is Josh Reeves. I love each and every one of you. And we will see you tomorrow for the broadcast. You guys have yourselves a great one. Take care.